hoping that's on. Are we good down there? We're all good down there. That's fantastic.
Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
We are we're continuing our nice, gentle, lightweight, easy listening tour through Paul's letter to the church at Rome. And we've reached chapter 3 this morning. If you want to follow it, if you've got a Bible, that's great. Or I should say, if you've got the Bible app these days, that'll be great. But these, I mean, they're challenging, aren't they? At least they are when I read them. And they are when I prepare them, for sure. James, are we okay to get the presentation? Oh, fantastic. That's brilliant. Let me just check that all the technology works. Look at that. Ooh, cool. Okay, so these, we're in chapter 3. And these are opening chapters of the book of Romans. Are really, as I said before, they're kind of setting the backdrop for the gospel. Paul is going to go on to explain the power and the authority and the glory of Jesus' death and resurrection and the impact of that on your life and my life. But in order for us to understand that, he has to spend these opening chapters explaining why Jesus had to die. And it's very, very painful and uncomfortable reading, and it's very challenging. And today is no different, believe it or not. But it's really important that we grasp this, because he's painting this backdrop, as I put this nice black backdrop up here, against which the glory of the gospel can be seen. And unless we understand what it is Jesus has saved us from, we will not grasp what a wonderful thing it is that he has done. And, you know, the songs we've been singing this morning already, oh, praise the name of the Lord our God. Why do we do that? Because hopefully we've got some grasp of what it is Jesus has saved us from. Because if he's just there to make things better for ourselves, then I think we're missing really what it is all about. And we'll come on to that. And like I said a few weeks ago, this is almost like hitting that factory reset button on your iPhone or on your mobile phone or other electronic device. These chapters are bringing us back to the authentic Christianity that Jesus came to this earth, lived and died and was resurrected for. And, you know, that's why these are so exciting chapters. Actually, even though they are a challenge for us. So last week we finished going through chapter 2, and Chris did a great job of again, another challenging passage in helping us to understand what this is about. And if you can remember last week, if you heard it or you've seen it online, then Paul was making the point that Chris elaborated, that your person is not a Jew just because they are born a Jew, meaning they're not a person who is one of God's family. They're not born into being one of God's people just because they are naturally born a Jew, but they are one of God's people, a true Jew, if you like, because their heart has been changed by the Spirit of God. And you're a Jew, one of God's people, if you're one inwardly, in that sense. And Chris made the point, you know, that for us today, a man or a woman who's not a Christian is not a follower of Jesus if he's just one outwardly. You can come to church, you can pray, you can read the Bible, you can do good and helpful things. That doesn't make you a Christian. But a man or a woman is a follower of Jesus if his heart has been changed by the Spirit of God. And yes, there are then repercussions that should be seen in our lives when that happens. And actually, we'll get into some of those in the coming weeks as we continue through this letter to the Romans. And so Paul continues in chapter 3 today and continues with the same discussion, really. So the chapters, remember Jonathan said the other week, the chapters are all quite recent, but he wrote this as one long letter. So Paul is continuing the same thing. And so he has this kind of role play scenario with himself, if that helps you understand it, all right? And he's kind of doing two sides of a little discussion going on to help us understand what he's trying to say. And so on the one hand, he's saying, you know, if, as you say, Paul, in chapter 2, a person is not a Jew just by being born a Jew, but actually they need a change inwardly, what, is there any advantage in being a Jew then? And Paul says, well, yes, because the word of God has come to you. To the Jews has been revealed the grace and the message of God. So yes, there is an advantage. But actually with that comes great responsibility. And so Okay then, Paul. Well, if that's true, what about all those Jews that actually aren't one inwardly then? Because you've just made the point that you're only a Jew if you're one inwardly. What about those Jews that aren't one inwardly? Does their lack of faith in God mean that God's faithfulness is irrelevant? If the very people that God has entrusted his word to them reject God, doesn't that nullify God's faith? No, says Paul. The unfaithfulness of man, the unfaithfulness, the lack of faith of men and women does not nullify God's own faithfulness. In other words, the unfaithfulness of mankind never alters the faithfulness of God. And although we read that 2,000 years ago, that is so key for you and me today. Because it means when we are not faithful in following God, he has not changed. And he remains faithful to his plans, to his purposes, to his love for you and for me, for his desire for the world to know him. And it doesn't change one jot or iota. And as much as you and I may screw up and make a right mess of things, as we all do, the reality is God's faithfulness has not changed. And that is good news. That really is good news. And so he carries on with this little role play. Well, okay, Paul. So in that case, if the Jews' unfaithfulness highlights God's faithfulness, isn't it unfair for God to punish the Jews? No. Right. And so he carries on. Yeah, but hang on a minute. If my sin increases God's glory, if I lie, if I do bad stuff, and actually by me doing bad stuff, I highlight how merciful God is because he forgives me, surely I'm doing God a big favour. Because I'm bringing his glory to bear by my own sin. Just to be really clear, Paul says, no, your condemnation is well deserved. So let nobody walk out of here this morning thinking that we've got to sin more in order to show how better God is. That is not, that's the argument Paul is making here. And he says, no, your condemnation is well deserved. And then he reaches this crowning statement in verses 10 onwards. Which is, it's a little bit like those John Grisham movies. Me and Andrew like watching the John Grisham films. You ever seen any of those? They're courtroom dramas, and they always end, or they seem to nearly always end, with this great scene in the courtroom. The barrister's been doing lots of interrogation of the witnesses and pulling out all his points and drawing out. And then he reaches the point where he stands in front of the jury, and he makes this great summation of everything that they've seen and heard over the last days or weeks. And he does this amazing, compelling speech to get them to swing their hearts to vote in his favour and for his case. And these few verses from verse 10 onwards in chapter 3 is like Paul started this work in chapter 1, and he reaches these verses in chapter 3, and there's this great summation now of the point that he is making and where all this has come to. And he pulls in numerous Old Testament quotes that he lays out for us all to see. And it's... it's unpleasant reading, let's be honest. I'm going to read from verse 9 of chapter 3. What shall we conclude then? Are we any better? Not at all. We've already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under sin. Everybody is under sin. No exception. As it's written, there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands, no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. Their throats are open graves. Their tongues practice deceit. The poison of vipers is on their lips. Their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery mark their ways, and the way of peace they do. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be silenced and the whole world held accountable to God. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing the law. Rather, what the law does is it makes us conscious of sin and we become aware of it. There's no excuse. There's no exception clauses in this summary that Paul gives us. All people, everywhere, no one is righteous. There is no one who seeks God. All are under sin. There's no one who does good. There is no fear of God in their eyes. Right? Clearly, there are people who do good, right, as we compare ourselves to each other. But when we compare ourselves to the holiness of God and the integrity of God and a creator God who has made you and me to worship him and follow him and love him forever, and we have turned our backs on him and said, no, thank you. That's why Paul writes this. And that's the fundamental beginnings of the gospel. The whole world is held accountable to God. No one is rescued by the law. It just makes us aware of what we do wrong. Wow. Right. But it's so important that we grasp this and don't run away from it. There is a tendency in Western Christianity today to slide away from these passages and look at other things that are a bit more palatable. But we need to grasp this and hold on to it because, as I said, it is the backdrop to why Jesus came and died and God raised him from the dead. So I've got six things quickly to go through. I had 10 the other week, so six is a breeze. So to go through quickly and help us understand why Paul wrote this. The first thing is this passage is the great leveler. Okay, it is the great leveler. We are all in the same position before God. All of us, every single one of us. We look around this morning, you know, and we think we're different from so-and-so, we're different from the person sat next to us, we're different from the person behind us, we're all come from different walks of life. But actually, what Paul is saying here, what this passage tells us is before God, we are all in exactly the same place. There is no difference. No one of you is any better than the next one. No one of us is any worse than the person sat next to us. Hallelujah. That's good, right? We're all in exactly the same place. Angie and I used to watch a TV program that was on a few years back called Secret Millionaire. I don't know if anybody else ever watched that. Good. And it was an interesting program. So as somebody who was incredibly wealthy, usually they were a self-made person, and then they go undercover in a deprived town or city in the UK and seek out charities who work to help help people in those parts of the town or the city. And they worked for like 2 weeks doing loads of stuff. And then at the end of 2 weeks, if they liked what they'd been a part of, they go, surprise, I'm not really who I say I am. I'm an incredibly wealthy person. I'd like to give you tens of thousands of pounds to help your cause and what you're doing here. And then they would go back to their life in their nice mansion and their five cars and all the rest of it, right? And so they were very different from the people that they were mixing with for those 2 weeks. This is not like that. This is the great leveler. We are all in the same boat, which is why that picture's there. Because if you read this in the message, Eugene Peterson says, we are all in the same sinking boat. We all need rescuing. Whether we are rich or poor, whatever schooling you had, whatever nationality you are, whatever your first language is, whatever neighborhood you live in, whatever your bank balance is, whether you earn a wage or you claim benefits, we're all in the same boat together. This is the great leveler. You know, when you look at that person who's doing something nice and you think, oh, they're a good person. They're a nice man or a woman. They're a sinner before God in need of God's grace. When you hold that newborn baby in your arms and go, woochie, goochie, goochie, goo. Aren't they lovely? Ooh. That newborn baby is a sinner in need of the grace of God. When you help that nice dear old lady across the road, you think, what a sweet person. That dear old lady is a sinner in the need of the grace of God. And it's so hard to talk about this, but this is the crux of this message, that we need to grasp that. And the problem is we have sanitized the gospel. We have domesticated our Christianity and made it something that is far more palatable to our eyes, when in reality what we seem to be doing is rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. Right? We need to get a hold of this, because if we get a hold of this, we will begin to grasp the wonder of what it is Jesus has truly done and not lose that edge of who he is and what he's achieved for us. This passage undoes any sense of superiority. We are all in the same place. You know, it's sad when I hear people come into church and think, I want to share what's going on in my life. I want to tell them what I'm struggling with, but I can't because you have all got it worked out. I just want to say, we haven't got it all worked out. if that's you this morning, we're all in this same mess together. We all screw up. Some of us have mastered bluffing it and hiding it, but the reality is we are all in this same mess together, working it out. This is the great leveller. So, second thing to help us process this passage is we need to understand that no one's goodness makes a single dent on this position before God. You know, such is the contrast of our sinful lives before the holiness of God that there is not one thing you and I can do to change the situation. So not only are we in this desperate state before God that we are, that he sees us and thinks we've walked away from him because we have, there is now nothing we can do to change that. Remember this, Paul started this back in chapter 1 by saying we're all under the anger of God. And this is the summation of that and why we are. And now there is nothing that we can do to change that situation. No matter how good we think we are in this stark position. We need someone to rescue us from this because we cannot do it ourselves. I don't know if you remember, about 3 years ago, there was a big story in the news about a football team of lads in Thailand that got trapped in a cave. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
In June and July 2018, a junior association football team was rescued from a cave in northern Thailand. 12 members of the team, aged 11 to 16, and their 25-year-old assistant coach entered the cave on the 23rd of June after a football practice session. Shortly afterwards, heavy rainfall partially flooded the cave system, blocking their way out and trapping them deep within. Efforts to locate the group were hampered by rising water levels and strong currents, and no contact was made with them for more than a week. The cave rescue effort expanded into a massive operation amid intense worldwide public interest and involving international rescue teams. On the 2nd of July, that's 9 days later, after advancing through a narrow passage, two British divers found the group alive on an elevated rock about 2.5 miles from the cave mouth. Rescue organisers discussed various options for extracting the group, including whether to teach them basic underwater diving skills to enable their early rescue, to wait until a new entrance to the cave was found or drilled, or to wait for the floodwaters to subside by the end of the monsoon season months later. After days of pumping water from the cave system and a respite from rain, the rescue teams hastened to get the group out of the cave before the next monsoon rain, which was expected to bring additional downpours and was predicted to start around the 11th of July. Between the 8th and the 10th of July, all 12 of the boys and their coach were rescued from the cave by an international team. The rescue effort involved more than 10,000 people, including more than 100 divers, scores of rescue workers, representatives from 100 government agencies, 900 police officers, 2,000 soldiers, 10 police helicopters, 7 ambulances, more than 700 diving cylinders, and the pumping of more than 1 billion litres of water from the caves were required. Now, those lads trapped in that cave, which caught the world's headlines at the time, could do nothing to get themselves out of that situation. They were literally way out of their depth. That is where we are before God when we are born into this world. That's the reality of this message. And in that story, the huge amount of human effort that went into rescuing those lads and that football team from they needed an outside agency to come and rescue them. They could not do it themselves. And brothers and sisters, we need an outside agency to come and rescue us because we cannot do it ourselves. And I want to say this morning that the work of Jesus Christ on the cross is far greater than what I've just read. Far more significant than what I've just talked about. That he has come. He is the outside agency that has come to rescue you and me and this world out there from that position of being sinners before God and under his wrath. There is nothing that we can do to help make a change there. We need an outside agency, and that is Jesus. Third thing I want to say this morning is that what Paul writes here, this is the only position if we don't respond to Jesus. There is no other way. We remain under God's anger. Changing religion makes no difference. Being an atheist makes no difference. Molding a God after your own ideas makes no difference. Burying your head in the sand makes no difference. It's like going on a walk and you're going on a walk and you need to get over there, but there's a big river to cross and you can't figure out how to get across, but you have a map So you open up the map, and the map shows you the one way to get across that river. There is only one way, no matter what else we may think. The fourth thing I want to just talk about that helps us understand this passage a little bit better, because when we first read, I've had the advantage of spending a few days on it, right? When you first read it cold, it's a bit like a kick in the teeth. All right, because it's really hard to grasp. And with credit to Francis Chan for this analogy, the rope here, I don't know if you can you see the rope okay? Is that, thank you. I've always wanted to do this, excuse me. Oh yes, there we go. So this rope on the wall here represents our life, represents your life and my life, okay? But our lives go on for eternity, which cunningly is why you can't see the other end of the rope, because it goes on and on and on and on for eternity. And this tiny little red bit down here, not the light, but the thing I'm pointing at, the dark bit, which is about that tiny bit there, that's our lives on this earth. That's your life and my life on this earth. And then after we die, we've got all of this that goes on and on and on and on in eternity. And the question is, where will we spend that? Where will we spend that eternity? Because we have this short little time here. Then we meet Jesus, and then we have this. And helping us to understand and grasp that actually what we do in this life affects the rest of it. It's a Gladiator quote, isn't it? What we do in this life echoes through eternity. Yeah, you've seen it, yeah. and it's true, right? But Paul is leading up to us making the decision, because for every single man and woman listening to this and out there, they will die and they will stand before Jesus and have to give an account for their lives. And if we begin to grasp what it is God has done, what he has achieved, then when we end our lives at this bit and we face eternity, we face it with Jesus and no other way. So that perspective of eternity is something that begins to help us grasp what Paul is talking about here. Fifth thing I want to cover is that this passage, as hard as it may seem, is also the start of the answer. The answer begins with us accepting our current condition. It's like a lot of things in life. We can only move on from where we are if we truly understand our current position. You know, back to going on a walk in the country again. If you're looking at a map and trying to figure out which route you're trying to take, you spend a bit of a while trying to understand, well, what does the map say? Have I got the map the right way around? And all this kind of thing, which we normally do. And then when you understand where you are on the map, you think, aha, right, we've got to go this way. In order, before we set off, we need to understand where we are. While ever we think that we are good enough, we don't understand where we are. While ever we think, I can do this, we don't understand where we are. While ever we argue with God and say, this isn't fair. While ever we compare ourselves to others and not God, we don't understand where we are. While ever we forget this and surround ourselves with distractions and entertainment and all kinds of other things that are out there to help do that, we do not understand where we are. But the moment we surrender, the moment we say, yep, the moment we say, you are God, and I am a sinner in need of your help and rescue, that is the start of the rescue. That is the start of changing things around completely. Truly accepting your surroundings and appreciating exactly where you are allows us to move on. And, you know, this passage, however hard it may be, a key part of becoming a Christian and a key part of moving on with Jesus is grappling with this and saying, yeah, Lord, I am a sinner, actually, compared to you and your holiness and your integrity and your love and your purity. And I recognize that. And I want to choose you, Lord. Help. And we should end up like those guys that heard Peter's sermon on the day of Pentecost and said, what must we do? What must we do? And you'll have to wait till next week for that. Right? But final thing I just want to talk about here, and with this I close, is you read a passage like this,
It helps to ask the question, why did Jesus die? I mean, that is what Paul is coming to in the rest of this chapter and subsequent chapters. And I want to leave us with this. Jesus did not die on a cross so that you and I could have a nice life. Jesus did not die on a cross so that everything could go well for you or for me. He didn't even die on a cross so that your prayers could be answered. And I tell you, if you follow Jesus, I guarantee that you will have trouble. He said it himself. I guarantee you will probably have sickness. I guarantee you will definitely face death, unless he comes again in the meantime. The problem is, if we reduce Jesus to someone who is primarily there to meet my needs, to fix the broken stuff in my life, we completely miss the point. And miss the power and the majesty and the glory of what it is he has done and the changes that he has been doing for these last 2,000 years. We will get disappointed, and we have sold out to a pale imitation of the real Jesus. However, the reason Jesus' hands and feet were nailed to a cross 2,000 years ago and he was hoisted up on it for all to see until he breathed his last, was to do what we cannot do, was to do what you and I cannot do. Like those lads in that cave in Thailand, couldn't rescue themselves. The reason he died on the cross 2,000 years ago was to move us from the position of being sinners under the anger of God to being sinners under the mercy, forgiveness, and redemption of God, so that when we hit that point at the end of our lives, we turn around and we look Jesus in the eyes, and he loves us and accepts us and welcomes us in. The reason he died on the cross was to take the Father's anger for your sin and for my sin, which we read earlier in chapter 1 is coming our way, but he died on the cross that it doesn't come our way because he took the anger of the Father on him as he died on that cross. And I want to say this is massive. And time doesn't permit, but we need to study this more. If you've got the books, I encourage you to pray about this passage and to read it and to make notes, because this is so huge. This is way more than Jesus dying to fix your life and my life. This is way more than just to make us happy or to fit some argument or some philosophy. This is huge. This moves us from an eternity in hell under God's anger to an eternity in heaven enjoying him forever. This moves us from the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of the Son that he loves. This is, and the trouble is, we've lost sight of that, and we've reduced Jesus to being somebody else who just wants nice things for us, and we just want him to fix things. And we need to begin to grasp the state that we were in before we encountered Jesus, and the state that we are now in because we have surrendered to him. Once we grasp this, once we place Jesus at the center of everything, once we grasp our sin and that it means we deserve God's anger and that God poured out his anger for us on his own son Jesus instead, and what Jesus has won, that has to demand a response from us, doesn't it? We have to respond, surely, you know, and there's two ways to respond. You know, we can harden our hearts to that message, or we can respond to Jesus. You know, even if we've been a Christian all these years, we can still respond to this message and come afresh to Jesus this morning. Paul writes elsewhere, today is the day of salvation. I want to encourage you, let's respond to what God is saying to us. You know, we go through these passages and we go through these chapters, not because it's a nice thing to do on a Sunday, but because we want to let God speak to our hearts, all of us, right? And I want to encourage us to respond to what Jesus is saying today and to grasp him today. And if today you're sat there thinking, you know, yeah, actually, I don't quite get all of this, but I do see a mess. And I do see a need to be out of that mess. And I do feel like I need rescuing and I can't do it myself. Then I want to encourage you not to leave this building without praying with someone to bring Jesus right into that situation. Amen. Amen.